Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
Kenny Holmes.
Robert Kraft, and I would like to note that we are both, Kenny, you and me, honoring the fine teams of Los Angeles today. Carol, I think we need to get you like the Galaxy soccer hat to kind of complete it.
Excuse me, LAFC, come on.
LAFC.
If you're listening only, we're wearing Rams and Dodgers hats, so it's an LA day here on Score the Podcast and presented by Spitfire Audio. And we're very excited about our guest who is not an LA guy.
Yeah.
I won't be surprised if he's wearing a Yankees or a Mets hat, maybe. We're talking about Oscar nominated and Emmy award winning composer Carter Burwell. You know his music from all of the Coen Brothers movies, all the way back from the Coen Brother movies, all the way back to the beginning.
I think we're even Galaxy and Coen. Please
continue.
There you
go. There you go. And a list of other incredible movies, and he also scores the Morning Show on Apple TV Plus, mm-hmm. which has got great recognition and is coming back for a second season. And he's got a new movie coming out with Denzel Washington and your girl Fran.
Yeah, and it's opening the New York Film Festival, which is a great slot for it. It's also interesting because I don't know if Carter has scored a Coen brother movie. This one is only one brother, Joel, for reasons that we may find
and
out.
And we didn't say what it is. The Tragedy of Macbeth.
The Tragedy
of
Macbeth,
Shakespeare
exactly.
On us.
So
we're excited to talk with Carter. I know that when we were putting together the documentary score, we made a trip to New York and we were trying to get Carter in, but he doesn't live in the city. And if you don't have a car and you have all this gear and you're trying to get to Long Island, it's not an easy task. So we tried really hard to get him in the dock and we weren't able to make that happen. So I'm definitely excited to talk with him, and you guys go way back. So it'll be a nice catch up moment for us.
Oh yeah. We've worked together. We actually went to school together. So I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, that's right.
He's a super interesting composer. Really interesting and unique, with a unique backstory, which I actually am looking forward to asking him about.
Well, we'll get to that in just a bit. But as always, before we get to our guests, we want to thank our sponsor, Spitfire Audio, maker of orchestral sample libraries for film composers. Whether you're just starting out or a seasoned professional, Spitfire has so many sounds you will love.
Yeah, and they're releasing new libraries pretty much, I guess it's every month, with the free lab series, which I always download because why not get a cool free sound from Spitfire? But you can get an entire orchestra for free in their BBC Symphony Orchestra Discover Edition, which, of course, I have and use.
It's so sweet. And not only the lab series, they've been coming out with a ton of new packages, purchasable packages, including the one today that we're going to play you a demo of, the Hammers package. Now, this one is developed and produced in collaboration with composer Charlie Clouser, who's known for his music in Saw, Resident Evil, Extinction, and he was a Nine Inch Nails keyboardist for a while there. Hammers features more than 1,000 sounds, including detailed hits, ensembles, over 800 live performance loops, including genre-bending warps, all captured and processed to be broadcast ready. And with this new array of explosive drums inspired by Charlie's extensive experience in rock and industrial production and crafted for modern cinematic uses, composers will have a uniquely powerful tool for creating hard-hitting rhythms. So we're going to play you a cue from that. This package is sweet. There's the drum hits in there. You can really ramp some stuff up with some of these sounds.
So I have a feeling
forward
that,
to that.
Amazingly enough, you could probably just load this package and score an entire horror film. I mean, the only thing that's missing are the screams. There might even be some screams in there. And the best
that'll come from the audience if you do your job.
You're right.
Thank you very much.
Best part about it is that if you're listening to Score the Podcast right now, you can get this package 25% off with your first purchase of any Spitfire Audio product with promo code SCORE20. 21. Should I say that again? Score.
Please do.
2021. 20,
And don't forget to do that as soon as possible. Nice. We never know when the promo code is going to expire. So use it while you can. Save 25%. I know one of our listeners sent us a note. He bought it was his first Spitfire order. He bought 20 packages and just saved a bundle. So if you can use it while you can, take advantage of it. And again, listen for that demo cue of Hammers today after the show.
I want to ask Composer Carol, do you use Spitfire? I can't remember.
All the time.
You're a devoted Spitfire user, right?
I am. One of my go-to piano sounds, and I record piano all the time. One of my go-to piano sounds is a mix of something from Kontakt and the Spitfire Audio Labs soft piano. And there's a full version of it too, but it's worth it. And I mean, it's free. The Labs version is free. So there's nothing better than that. But
how could you not use it?
Nice.
Yeah. How could you not? Yeah. So definitely check it out, please.
We love Spitfire. Shout out to them for partnering up with us and sticking with us for so many years. And they put out such great stuff. All right. Before we get to Carter, I wanted to bring up a conversation. A couple of months ago, I was on Twitter and I was having a conversation with a music supervisor, and he had posted that he was fed up with trailer music not representing the music of the film. And I thought, this is a really interesting subject, right? Because trailers come out. We've seen the YouTube video mocking how trailers are created. Get a cappella version of an old song sung slowly and a couple of drum hits here. And then you have some random trailer music and then the name of the film. And then you go watch it and it's Hans Zimmer or, Pinar Toprak's music. And it's not what you heard in the trailer. And it got me thinking, is that even possible? Is it possible for a composer to score the trailer? Oftentimes, the trailers are getting cut and created while the composer's still working. Sometimes they want to use a song. And I was wondering, Robert, from your perspective, does the composer ever want to score the trailer? Does this come up from when you're booking a composer? Has that ever come up in your history?
Well, first of all, can you imagine a composer saying, I'm going to be out of time, out of energy, out of ideas, the deadline's approaching. Can I please have another assignment to work with the marketing department on making the commercial for the movie? No composer wants to touch that. And as you said very accurately, the timelines are completely different. Sometimes you put a sizzle reel together or the first trailer, or what's called a teaser, a year before the movie comes out, 6 months before the movie comes out. Nobody's approved music. The composer doesn't know exactly what the vibe of his score is. The advertising department just needs to sell the idea of the movie. So very, very rarely does a composer get involved or want to get involved. Same with songs. I mean, you can have, and it's gone horribly wrong, where you have a great band writing songs for a movie or a great artist, and then they put Katrina and the Waves walking on sunshine in the trailer, and you think, wait a minute, we've just paid a band a fortune for an original song score, and yet the advertising department says, that's cool, but we need this to sell the trailer. So very, very different agendas. And before we started today's show, you mentioned one where it actually is happening.
Yeah, it just happened. And it was interesting because I was thinking about bringing this up anyway. And then just a couple of days ago, the Dune trailer comes out. Some people are saying that's Hans's music. Other people are saying it's a trailer. It's not Hans's music. And then Water Tower Music releases a cue, and it is Hans's music in the trailer. And I'm wondering if this is just, they're taking advantage of the fact that the movie was shelved and it was done and the score is done. And I wonder if, 007, No Time to Die will probably do the same thing. The Billie Eilish song has been out for a year And they're able to utilize this stuff because of this funky COVID timeline. But is this a one-off that Hans's music is in a trailer that you can remember? I was trying to think, and I couldn't remember anything specific.
I think you're right, and I think your analysis of why is correct in that now the timelines have converged. The music is completely done. The movie is completely done. The music clearly has a vibe that they want to sell the film, that it's appropriate. And so why don't we take a cue from the film and use it in the trailer? It's very rare. I can tell you, just before we get to Carter, of an experience I had that's the exact opposite of what you're describing. We were working on a wonderful motion picture called Abraham Lincoln and the Vampire Hunters, often called Abraham Lincoln and the Umpire Hunters.
Henry Jackman.
Yes, and I was working with Henry. He was on, I would think, his third version of the score, because for all of you composers out there, when a movie isn't entirely sure what it is, the composer inherits the assignment of, could you write a whole different approach to the music, and maybe that will help us. And Henry and I were just aware that they were really struggling to get the movie's tone correct. And he, let's try acoustic. Let's try electronic. Let's try. So we were kind of at a loss because the movie was in a little bit of a pickle. And the trailer needed to get made and come out. And so the marketing department of the studio released a new trailer for Abe Lincoln and the Umpire Hunters. And it was a Nine Inch Nails song that they put in the trailer, which was a good idea and had the right vibe that I think we were looking for. And suddenly, the score that wasn't correct at that point became clear. Wait, let's go down the like total industrial prog rock, hard rock vibe for the entire score. Instead of a couple cues, which Henry had already, let's just make the whole thing kind of slamming anvil sound, dark synth stuff, like this Nine Inch Nails song. And that's the way the score evolved, which was the result of somebody in the deep in the marketing department suggesting a Nine Inch Nails song for the trailer. I don't know of a lot of episodes like that where the trailer...
That's crazy.
We were at a loss.
It was totally inspired, and they were searching for something, and Bob from marketing now has that poster on his living room wall, and he's like...
Actually, Bob from marketing has that poster on his living room wall, but no one has ever told him, you know, dude, that you're responsible for the sound of the score, because we, Henry and I, at some screening, leaned over each other after they played the trailer, like, hey, everybody should see this before we screen the movie again, just a group of filmmakers. And Henry and I looked at each other like, that's cool. Maybe we should try it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I did want to point out, too, that when we were talking with Elliot Goldenthal and we were talking about Batman Forever and the marketing, they had the McDonald's commercial that we had that played in our show. It uses Danny Elfman's Batman theme, and it's Val Kilmer on the screen because he didn't have the music available to them yet, or they didn't. It wasn't presented to the McDonald's, whoever cut that commercial. It's really weird to see Val Kilmer as Batman and you hear Michael Keaton's Batman theme. And that threw me off because I hadn't heard that in years. And when I was pulling that up, I'm like, wait a second. So that's another example of like marketing stuff being done before the score, and they're already pushing the movie. But anyway, regardless, Hans Zimmer's Dune track, and there may be more than one, but the one that I heard, Paul's Dream, I can't wait.
Yeah.
It sounds amazing.
Amazing.
So a lot of stuff to be excited about. And the other thing, too, is trailer music gives a lot of people work. There's a lot of composers working on trailer music. So, you know, if there was a way for them to maybe get the theme or the motif to use in the trailer just to kind of get the vibe, that would be sweet. But I was just trying to think, like, how would that ever work? You hear all these horror stories about timelines.
Yeah.
So interesting. Well, thanks for clearing that up. I think we're good to go. We're going to take a break. And then coming up after the break, joining us from Long Island, Carter Burwell. Stick around. We'll be right back. Hey guys, it's Kenny. Back to the show in just a second. If you like Score the podcast, you're going to want to check out More Score. More Score already has hours of content waiting for you. You can listen to interviews with composers Zach Robinson and Leo Bierenberg of Cobra Kai and Carlos Rafael Rivera, the maestro behind The Queen's Gambit. Plus, we've done a sit-down with the founders of Spitfire Audio, Christian Henson and Paul Thompson, who share why not even an erupting volcano could stop them from launching the business. It's a pretty crazy story. More Score is our new Patreon show for Score superfans. And if you don't know what Patreon is, well, it's a website and an app that lets fans crowdfund the type of extra content you want. And with Patreon, you can listen or watch right on the app. It's really easy. And the best part about More Score, it's year-round, just like you asked for. No more off-season. Just go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score. We'll see you over there.
Hey, this is John Ottman. You're listening to Score the Podcast. And now let's go back to the show.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We are thrilled about our guest today. He's an Emmy-winning composer. He's scored films such as Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Carol, The Twilight Saga, and 16 Coen Brothers films, including Fargo, The Big Lebowski, No Country for Old Men, and the most recent, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He's also the maestro behind Apple's series The Morning Show and Netflix's Space Force. Please welcome Carter Burwell to the show.
It's our studio audience, and I just realized that when you said Carol, and Carol said yes, of course, we have to distinguish that Carter scored the magnificent film Carol.
One of my favorites.
I rewatched in my deep dive. And speaking of composer Carol, would you honor us by singing an A440 just to tune us up? Is that it?
Yeah.
That wasn't it.
Kenny, sing us an A440.
There it is.
No, the audience is dropping off.
Oh, God.
Carter, you're an East Coast guy, right? You're joining us from New York?
Yes, I'm actually at the end of Long Island at the moment. Yep, that's right, New York.
That's nice.
Oh, how brutal.
Montauk or?
Yeah, I'm in Amagansett, the next town in. And I like to say I'm as far from the industry as I can be without being in the ocean.
That's funny. I like that. And it's also, besides being beautiful, a historic location for artists.
Yes, absolutely.
Pollock.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you feel inspired out there?
I do. It's very beautiful and sometimes awe-inspiringly beautiful and also very peaceful. I love it.
Tell me, do you, first of all, it's great to see you. It's been a while.
It's good to see you. I know. It has been a while.
It's been a while. And you may need to remind me also, because I've never been entirely clear. Some people have said that we were classmates, and I don't know if that was entirely accurate.
What year were you?
1976.
77. So not quite classmates.
You're a young man.
Yeah, that's right.
tell me what it's like.
I'm feeling dumb in this room right now with all these Harvard guys. Should I leave right now? Or?
And in fact, I'm going to just use this opportunity since Carter and I don't get enough chance to talk. Will you remind me, for our audience, Carter and I attended the same illustrious institution. I was not allowed in the music department, something I now am blessed by sharing. Carter, were you a music major?
No, I wasn't. And I only even really became interested in music my last year there and managed to, I found out they had an electronic music studio in the sort of the attic of the music department, which otherwise was just very 1970s classical music oriented, you know, which meant serial composers like Milton Babbitt and stuff, which was not of interest to me, but the electronic music studio was of interest. And the guy who ran it, Ivan Cherepnin, was nice enough to let me use it, give me a key. And, I spent a lot of time, up there, I have to say.
Can you tell me, because I will never know otherwise, what was in that studio? And here, there was something right there, and I never knew it. What was it? Some gear that's
it was now stuff
prized.
Well, it was stuff that Ivan really put together himself. His brother, Serge Turepin, actually made synthesizers called a brand called the Serge Synthesizer. So he had that there. He had a Buchla and a lot of tape machines. And then weird stuff that only Ivan would have, like a parabolic mic that he would stick out the window to pick up. We'd like basically spy on people walking by outside and take those conversations and send them into tape loops. And we'd basically spend a whole, maybe an hour setting up a system. And then we'd spend another hour sitting and listening to the system, listening to how the people outside were controlling what was in our room and that kind of thing. It was very much a mindset about what constitutes music.
Do you think that experience launched you into a kind of pivot into music?
It really did contribute to it. That was one pivotal experience. Seeing Ivan do that, and I just thought, wow, the fact that he knew where to plug that cable in was just the sexiest thing I'd ever seen. I thought, well, I want to know how to do that. And then the other thing was, I saw that same year, my last year at Harvard, saw Iggy Pop perform at the Harvard Square Theater with I think Blondie was opening for them, and David Bowie was playing piano for him, and it was just the most exciting thing I'd ever seen. And I was planning at that time to go to architecture school, and I just thought, I think I could take a year off and maybe just go to New York and try music, and that's what I did.
That's amazing. What a year, too. 77, 78.
It was a good year.
Total punk, birth of punk, kind of hip-hop about to show up. Where did you live in Manhattan?
Well, it wasn't. I'd also like to say you could go to CBGB's and you might see Philip Glass play, too. Talking Heads, like at the Poetry Project, and all these different people, Patti Smith, Steve Reich. And punk, it was all happening, and there was a dissolution of borders that was very important for me, I have to say. Sorry, you asked where I lived?
Yeah.
I was, let me see, all over the place. I think, I lived like a musician, so I was like moving around. I would sometimes not be in New York. I went to Manchester for a month to record a record for Factory Records, and I was also my day job was I was an animator, so I went to Tokyo for a few months to work on an anime there. And
I was gonna say, this was right around the time your famous the blockbuster Help, I'm Being Crushed to Death by a Black Rectangle came out. Can you explain, because that's your first credit on IMDb and it's not as a composer.
That's right. It's a hand-drawn animated film that I did actually in college, but it went around to the festivals and things, the animation festivals. I did a variety of things.
Yes. Is there room for Help, I'm Being Crushed to Death by a Black Rectangle 2? Can we expect to see that?
Yeah, this is the era of bringing things back.
I know. I'll be honest, I miss animation, but I'm sure I'm not telling you something you don't already know if I say it takes a lot of time and patience, and I'm not sure that I have those things today.
Did you score that film as well?
I did. I played piano to score it, played a sort of improv piano score to it. Yeah.
Is it online anywhere? I was trying to find it.
No, I've got a 16 millimeter print of it, and I do sometimes think, I got to digitize that, but I just haven't gotten around to it. I know Museum of Modern Art has it in the collection, but I don't think it makes it out very often.
After that experience, did you have any sort of thought of like, I can continue on in animation? Because pretty soon after, it was just a few years after you got your first composing gig, but Was animation the vision at that point?
It was what I was doing. I've never, to this day, I still don't really feel like I have a career in mind. But I was doing animation. That's right. I would do either independent hand-drawn animation, get gigs wherever you could, like at Children's Television Workshop or whatever, I was doing computer animation, which was a relatively new thing at the time. I learned how to do it basically on my own, but also at the MIT Media Lab. And That was, you know, could always find a job doing that because there were just so few people doing it. Today, there are tens, hundreds of thousands of people do it. But then you could really literally know everyone who did it. There were like dozens of people in the world. So I did that too. And that's what I did when I went to Tokyo. I was basically their 3D computer animator guy.
Were you always techie as a kid or were you musical? Like, what was your childhood like?
Well, I was, I guess, a techie, but what tech did we have when I was a kid? It was,
Etch-a-Sketch.
Yeah, it's, you know, cassette recorders and things like that. But my way into music, honestly, was sort of the tech door. That's why I went to the electronic music studio at Harvard instead of through the main door of the music department. I figured I don't know anything about music, but I know a little bit of electronics. I know a little bit about computers and figured that would sort of help me to get into it.
I really like the fact that I'm learning in some ways why, one reason why not only are your scores really original and different from a kind of traditional approach in many ways, but hearing you say you're still looking for your career, that you have a background in animation, that you started in this electronic music lab, none of these point to a very traditional route into music or film scoring, which in some ways we've been blessed with the result, which is a really unorthodox, Carter, really unorthodox approach to film scoring, which is makes you unique and clearly has been the basis of why you've done so many pictures. I think 90 is the number. I made this note. When we do something like this, I go back and just listen as much as I can. The first thing that struck me about the scores was how much space is in them. I don't know another word. You nod. Why?
Yeah, well, I agree. And indeed, whenever we spot a film, you know, when we're talking about where music should go, I'm the first person in the room to say, I don't think we need music there. You know, I do tend to think that feature films are overscored, that directors, producers, executives tend to underestimate their audience and they want to make sure nobody misses, you know, a piece of information. So they like hammer it home, and I prefer to do the opposite.
That's in true. Some ways, that's one of the hallmarks of what you've brought to film scoring too, which is I'm not going to manipulate you with an on-the-nose, here's the spot, here's the cue, here's how you should feel.
You better be sad now.
Yeah, it remains, there's space, and I thought, this is, even in the arrangements, it's not this kind of wall-to-wall thick arrangement. You hear the elements. You hear a bass or a clarinet or, you know, a whistle or an odd thing. And I just thought that's unique.
Well, you know, it has to be said that, you know, most of those 90 films are independent films without orchestral budgets, right? So, you know, I've talked to Tom Newman about this. You know, we both agree that orchestrating for the small, inexpensive films is a lot more fulfilling in a way because you really, like you say, every instrument you write for, you're going to hear them. It's not like this person sitting next to three other people who are all playing the same note.
Or 30. And,
yeah, or 30. And so it makes the orchestration a lot more challenging but more fulfilling. And I think that you also get something special from the musicians when they know they can't hide. They're like, you know, you are going to hear them.
So you really... I mean, the benefit of just listening to some of these scores and hearing virtually every note, it isn't a big pad of strings. I never thought it was budget-related, though everything is. And it's funny, you're interviewed. I saw one interview where some newsman asked you what's the first thing that you have to tackle on a film score, and you said, well, I have to understand the budget. And he laughed. What? The budget? Come on. I mean, and you said exactly what's correct, which is, do I have millions of dollars to blow here, or do I have to be very careful about how I spend the money? I think the other thing that is really a hallmark of your work is your ability to use dissonance in a way that doesn't leap out with a big neon sign, this is dissonant. It's either a grace note or a note that says something very important by being not what you'd expect. I don't know if that is... when you talk about your, the way you came to it, if that's either, it's a hard question or stupid one, maybe, is it intentional? Oh, I know what I'm going to use here. Or is there something that you feel, you know, you have latitude because you haven't come at it with the, this is right and this is wrong.
Another way of saying I don't know what I'm doing, but that's true.
That I, you know, politely asking,
but no, but it's true. I of course could have studied music theory. I studied a lot of other things in my life. I sort of chose to work with music at a more intuitive level. You know, coming more from the heart than from the brain, and I kind of like walled it off early on that way. Of course, over the years, of course, I've been forced to learn music theory, and I can't orchestrate without knowing a lot about that. But yeah, it's the way I hear is the way that I hear, and I'm not trying to. I never learned to, you know, write a Bach chorale. I never. You know, if you actually went to through a normal conservatory training, you would learn by basically taking on different styles and different periods of music and stuff like that. And I never did that. I basically, my writing is based upon the things that I've heard in my life that I liked. And if so, so some of my harmonies were probably Bulgarian because I just happen to like some of those Bulgarian, those harmonies, you know, which you would call a dissonance, you know, but the Bulgarians wouldn't, you know, things like that.
Ooh, it's, I like that.
It's just what I happen to have, you know, how I've trained myself in a way.
So we talked about your animation and you're in that process and you're interested in music. And then the 80s come around, you're playing in bands in the early 80s, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, not as a profession, as a, you know, a thing to do at night. Yeah.
And at what point do the Coen brothers, who were making their first film, come in contact with you? How does that relationship start? Because you both started each other's careers.
Yeah, I know. So I know it's. I try to, you know, young composers come and ask me how to break into the business, and my story isn't very helpful, but I try to find something helpful in it. It's basically, the helpful part is I was out there playing music. In other words, if you wait for someone to call, it's not going to work, but you have to get your work out there. And fortunately, as a musician, it's not that hard. You can go and play, you know, so many places, you know, play in the subway, play on the street, play whatever. And I was playing at CBGB's, spots like that, Mud Club, the places of that period. And someone that I knew through that scene, he's a bass player. His day job, just like my day job, was I was an animator. His day job was he was doing sound editing for television and film. And he called me up and said, you know, I'm working on this independent film, low budget independent film, these guys that are our age, and you know, they need music, they've got no money. I think the kind of stuff you do, because even though I was playing at CBGB's, I would play instrumental music. You know, if you probably heard it today, you'd say it still sounded a little like me. And he thought maybe that would be appropriate to this first film, and said I said sure, yeah, why not. So I met Joel and Ethan through Skip Leafsay, who still to this day is their sound editor. And that's how that came about. And, you know, they were, I guess, interviewing composers. You know, the people who had bankrolled their film, who were largely just like lawyers and dentists back in Minneapolis, you know, they were hoping that Joel and Ethan would hire people who knew what they were doing. So they interviewed a lot of other composers. Joel later told me these were the strangest audition interviews he's ever done. Like, they interview and audition actors all the time, right? But he found the composer personality the most weird. And, you know, because it'd be things like Jan Hammer shows up wearing shorts, you know, and sandals and opens up a briefcase and hands him a contract. Says, hey, this is the contract. You signed it. I will do your music, you know. And it was like a whole bunch of things like that, according to Joel. But in the end, the way it worked was that I saw a reel of their film. I didn't have anything to play for them, really. So I went home, spent the weekend just putting together some sketches, brought them in a few days later, and they lived with those for months, I think, while they were cutting, and eventually decided that they wanted to go with me.
Do you remember how you orchestrated those sketches? Did you actually hire players, or was it just you?
Oh, it was very much just me. It was very much just me, but it was at a time when some of it was piano. I was also doing a lot of tape stuff, so, playing tapes backwards and tape loops, and I was doing a lot of synthesizer stuff. So it ranged from music that would be more to be the kind of thing you'd expect in a sort of noir thriller like Blood Simple, to stuff that was sort of the opposite. And we used some of the more expected stuff, but in the end, the more of the opposite stuff actually tended to be they ended up using more of. Like, there's a piano, basically repeated piano thing that I wrote that kind of brought a humanity to the characters. You know, Joel and Ethan, warmth of feeling isn't something that's at the top of their list when they're writing a script. But Fran McDormand, when she's in their movies, she brings it, and she's in Blood Simple. That was also her first film. She met Joel on that film. They got married. She brings that, and this piano tune kind of brought that too. And as we were just sitting around the studio, and Ethan would hear me just playing it, improvising, he'd say, "Yeah, let's have more of that." And we recorded more and more of that, and less of the synth stuff. But their original concept, I think, was more that it would be the synth material. But a nice thing about them is that they are very willing to try out new things, and the score just kind of drifted in that direction. And indeed, our relationship, continued to drift in that direction, to where for Miller's Crossing, I kind of wrote a sappy Irish tune, orchestral, tune to go with this very cold, brutal movie. But that kind of became part of my job with them, is to play the warmer side of life.
We've talked to several composer duos where it's two musician composers working with one director. But when you're working with two directors, how does that differ from when you're working with a solo director? Do they get into battles about ideas? Are they pretty much always on the same page? Like, how do you guys sit into a room and decide what you're gonna do musically when you have two different directors? Does that ever come up?
Well, most of the time, you could safely say that they're on the same page. And this is true. It's true in pre-production, it's true on the set, and it's true in post-production. They're like, if you're on their set, one of them will go up and talk to one actor, and one goes and talks to another actor, and they get twice as much done in the same amount of time. We all assume that they're on the same page. Now, I have seen times when they disagreed about something musical, but that's rare. But, it does happen, and then we kind of like, we figure it out. We try this, we try that, and we figure it out. But
are they musical?
Ethan plays guitar. I think he probably sings. He probably plays other instruments too. I wouldn't be surprised if he picked up a violin and played it. He is musical. I think Joel doesn't play instruments, but you can tell from their movies that they both take music very seriously. It's some of their movies are basically about music, like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Yeah. Right. So, or Inside Llewyn Davis. They grew up listening to folk music. It's really important to them. And one of the things that's important to them about it is the concept of authenticity, is one of the touchstones of folk music. And they take that on. They, like working on, say, True Grit, if I could play them a hymn that I wrote, and I could play them a hymn that's from an 18th century hymn book, and they might like them both, but the moment I tell them that this one's from an 18th century hymn book, now they're really interested, because it has an authenticity that they just love. And sometimes it comes back and bites me, but that's the way they one of the ways they get into music.
I want to know if after Blood Simple, did you have a moment of feeling like these guys and my relationship to them is my future? Or was it still, was it random for a long time?
Well, you know, it seemed random then. They were very, when we were working on Blood Simple, they were very honest with me in a way that not most, you know, it's not a common thing in the film world where they're saying, you know, this movie will probably never come out. You'll probably never get your deferred payment. Don't hold your breath. And then it did, like after a year, it finally did come out. It finally, like, people start, rather than looking at it as a sort of a an oddly made film noir, people started to look at it as an artfully made film noir. And so then it played at Toronto Film Festival, and then it played at New York Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And but even then, that was, I went to see it there, and people sat respectfully, watched the film, but no one was laughing at all the really funny parts because they just weren't used to Joel Nathan's sense of humor, right? It's a very particular thing to be able to laugh at, you know, a sock sticking out of a wood chipper. And, you know, they're, that's a different movie, of course, but
yes, it's a great scene.
But a great scene, but that's their films. Even, you know, No Country for Old Men, there's scenes that make you laugh and you can't explain why everything that's going on. It's just horrible. But you, the way that they distance you from it and their particular look of, at it makes you laugh. Anyway, what I was getting at was that, yeah, then I saw it, Blood Simple, months later at a midnight showing, and everyone was screaming and everyone's shouting out the lines, and everyone, you know, the reaction is so completely different than at the film festival. And then when they got the green light to do Raising Arizona, Ethan called and said, you know, we've got this other script. You know, it's takes place in the West, like a Western, but a contemporary Western, and it's going to be, yeah, it's got to be country. It's not going to, you know, it's just not going to be as hip as, you know, Blood Simple. And I don't know. I think, you know, you might be too groovy for this. What do you think? And, or maybe he said, it might not be groovy enough for you anyway. I said, well, let me read it. And I just thought it was a fantastic script. I'm just, as a piece of literature, I thought it was wonderful. So I felt I had to work on it. I didn't at that point have any plan for doing another film. I thought, this is just really, you know, an amazing thing. So yeah, I'll do it. And I went out and visited while they were shooting out in Scottsdale. And so I did that. And I think at that point, once those two films were so different and the scores were so different, I feel like at that point, there was sort of a tacit understanding that probably I was going to keep doing their movies. And the next film they did is the one where their choice to hire me was just crazy because it was Miller's Crossing and they wanted an orchestral score. And they knew perfectly well that I didn't know anything about orchestral music, just
wow,
really nothing. And they could have at that point hired anybody, right? They, you know, they could have hired John Williams to do it, but they hired me. And so that's just a test of, you know, loyalty. And the fact that they were willing to let me do that means, but yeah, I think,
you've,
yeah,
glossed over something that I am really eager to know, which is, so they wanted an orchestral score. Did you have to crack open books? Did you say, hire an orchestrator? How do you get to suddenly become an orchestral composer if you haven't done it?
Well, so I will say part of my personality is I love being thrown in at the deep end of a situation, and that was certainly that. So, and they had told me before they went to shoot what they had in mind, just wanted to make sure that it was okay with me that I was going to do this thing. And so while they were away, basically what I did was bought every orchestral score to every piece of orchestral music that I liked or thought might be relevant, just like my favorites, you know, so Stravinsky, Penderecki, Brahms, you know, you name it. And I would just listen to it, read the score, stop, go back 8 bars, listen again, you know, just say, oh, this is what they do with the French horns. Oh, that's what they do with the English horn. You know, it's like sort of teaching myself what I could by listening to stuff I like. It's an entirely pleasurable, you know, experience.
It's wonderful.
But we also, you know, when we did Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, we honestly didn't know what we were doing, even in terms of technically like synchronizing music to picture or anything. Yeah. Right. But for Miller's Crossing, it was a grown up movie. We knew it was a bigger budget. We knew, you know, that the investment Fox was making in it, I think it was a negative pickup for Fox, that was, we had to do a good job. And so we hired people who knew what they were doing. We hired a music editor for the first time. We hired an orchestrator for the first time. A conductor.
When the studio got involved, though, were they concerned that you didn't, you weren't the orchestra guy? Because there's, now you're dealing with the studios. This isn't so independent anymore, and you're, everyone's a little more established now. Was there pushback right. with?
I didn't get any of that, but you know, those attitudes were around at the time. I forget, we were talking about like 87, 88. I remember Danny Elfman was taken to task, you know, often by, you'd talk to composers in L.A. and they would, you know, because he was a rock and roller. And I'm sure Hans experienced this when he started. You know, there was a prejudice and a pushback on people who weren't conservatory trained. And I remember when I joined the Musicians Union, I'm in Local 47 in L.A., I couldn't write down that I'm a synthesizer player. Because at the time, synthesizer players were the people who put musicians out of work. There was that prejudice. So there were all these things that are these prejudices that are locked in time. And I remember them back then. The people I worked with, though, I think we were kind of feeling out. You know, Ethan was helping with this. Like, we don't want a guy who's going to think Carter's an idiot. if we want someone that's going to help him. So we found this orchestrator, Sonny Kompanik, who basically became my teacher of how
fantastic
to orchestrate.
Guy.
He's a fantastic guy. And he's really sweet. He did, in fact, teach orchestration at NYU. And he was my, basically, teacher. I would look over his shoulder and I'd say, so why did you do this? And why did you do that? And, you know, how can we make this work? And that he's the person that I learned from. You know, we hired a conductor then. But right away, I did feel like there's something weird about a conductor coming in who's never seen the music before, just stepping up on the stage and waving his arms. And after that, I started asking Sonny to conduct because he's the one who would put the pencil to the page. And then when I started orchestrating, I also started conducting on Fargo. I think it was the first time I orchestrated and conducted myself because I just felt like, you know, the person who's conducting should be the one who knows the most about the music.
Yeah. And can get the orchestra to sound that way. I think just before we take a moment to catch our breath and take a break, I love the fact that you've now identified the exact opposite of where we are today, which is if you say you have orchestral training, the director say, you know what, we need a guy that has just learned his instrument and also has been doing raves after 4 a.m. who will score the film, because they always say, I want this to sound incredibly different. So if you know anything about music, it's just perfect to know, as we all know, things just go full circle every different period in filmmaking and in life and in art. So now if you've never done a movie, you are really in demand. So
that's right. And I know, Robert, you and I have both lived through cycles of everyone wants a synth score, everyone wants an orchestral score, then back to the synth score, then back to the orchestral score. You know, it's like, what? Yeah.
And directors not being clear that now, it's almost indistinguishable. Half of it,
right, exactly.
Half of it is orchestra. The orchestra has all sampled, you know, from Abbey Road and from, drums that were recorded on the Fox stage, and they go, well, who played drums? Well, you know, a guy in the back room played it on a keyboard from a program and a plug-in. But it's now, it just keeps going. I wonder what's next. We should be able to predict after our break.
We're going to take a break. That was such a long wind-up to the break there, Robert.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. Much more with Carter Burwell right after this. Let me take it from here, Kenny. Kenny just tossed a break, and now I'm going to take it from here and tell you about More Score. You've been hearing us talk about it. Some people might be thinking, I just learned what a podcast is. Now I'm supposed to learn what a Patreon is. What is a Patreon? Matt, can you enlighten us a little bit on the idea of Patreon and why More Score is existing today?
So Patreon is a website that basically lets us crowdsource or crowdfund shows. So we can go out and produce podcasts that are extra, that aren't, these aren't something that any sponsorship is paying for. This is something that you, the listeners, you, the fans, are helping us create. And because of that, we have a direct line of communication with you, and we can hear the things that you think are worth us going out and pursuing, chasing down interviews with people that are interesting. And of course, we'll be bringing you those. We have already really interesting guests that have given us pretty amazing insight into things like the Queen's Gambit, Carlos, you know, who turns out was a big fan of our documentary, and that was kind of a cool thing.
That was
sweet. And then Zach and Leo from Cobra Kai, which is, you know, we talk about their path going from interns, getting us coffee. And when we visited Chris Beck's studio, and then going on to score basically one of the most kind of innovative and really kind of outlandish in the best way music for anything that is happening right now in Cobra Kai. And so we're talking to these people that might not ordinarily be in Score the Podcast. You know, we have a fairly short season. Well, that's not an issue anymore because more score is year round.
Crowdsourced and crowdfunded. What I'm wondering is, what if you don't like crowds?
Well, this is we have an answer for this.
Thank you.
You don't ever have to come in contact with anyone.
Oh, wow.
You just can hit play on your device and just
as soon as you said that to the five new patrons.
I'm telling you, it's a game changer.
It is really cool though, you guys, because if you haven't joined yet, you haven't seen the layout, go on the app. You don't have to sign up to check out the page. You do have to sign up to check out all of the videos and stuff, but you can see the layout. But there's a mailbox that you can message us directly and say, hey, I have an idea, or maybe you should interview so-and-so. So you're kind of like part of the production team, part of the meeting. You know, you can throw around some ideas. And of course, there's also some exclusive merch if you join. So at a certain tier, you get a t-shirt, another tier, you get a t-shirt and a coffee mug, which the mugs are so sweet. I don't even have one yet, because it's exclusive to the patrons.
Too, by the way.
So you actually can't get it anywhere else.
It's produced through them and we can't make it outside of that. Yeah. They must do that on purpose to encourage people.
Can't even get
that.
The host.
But yeah.
One
anyway,
of those.
If you support our show and throw a few extra bucks our way, then it's part of our thank you to that. And, obviously, we appreciate everyone who is helping to make more score possible. We've been so encouraged by the growth of this. It's super exciting. So, check it out. And, we'll I think this is the third read that we've done about more score in a row.
I don't wear these clothes.
We're wearing the same clothes.
I don't wear these like every 2 weeks on the day just for this read.
See, you can kind of blend in a little bit because that's just like a dark colored plain shirt. And Robert, maybe you too. But the hat gives it away for Kenny.
Yeah. Well, I'll wear a hat next time. I got a couple hundred, so.
You just got to switch out the
hat. You know what I'm
missing,
though? I think this is a good finale for our three pitches. I'm hoping that included in the merch at some point will be a score baseball. Because, man, I'd wear that. I would wear that everywhere so that people would say, where'd you get that cool hat? And I'd say, so have you ever heard of Patreon? And I could do the whole pitch right there. I need my
It'll
hat
be the too. New now everyone's talking about cryptocurrency. Robert's gonna be like, you guys know about Patreon? That's right.
Patreon Patreon dad hats, man. It's the new thing.
But no, seriously, we hear everybody and we see your messages when we're out of season. When are you coming back? The season was short, and we wanted to come up with a way to have a year round season, and this was a way. You know, there's operating costs of the show. We spend a lot of time doing these things to make them sound great and make them sound professional and make content that you guys want to hear. So this is a way to do that. But we need your support. And we think you'll really like what we have to offer. And there's a ton of hours already of content. So you're already behind if you're not on board. So join now. And you'll get everything that we've already done, plus what's to come, which there's a lot in the hopper. So we'll see you on more score.
It's a lot of fun, and it's just so much fun to have chats with a lot of these people that are just truly innovating things. Very, very cool. More Score on Patreon, patreon.com/morescore, or download the Patreon app and search More Score, and we will see you there.
This is Andy Grush.
This is Taylor Stewart,
and we are the Newton Brothers, and you are listening to Score the Podcast. Let's go back to the show.
Let's do it.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're here with Carter Burwell. Carter, we talk to composers who are on the East Coast, and we often ask, why didn't you move to LA? But I was looking on your website, and I think I might have figured out the reason why, and it has to do with the movie Airheads. Can you just walk us through the last day of recording on Airheads?
As an story East Coaster, I don't know.
As an East Coaster, I don't know if this is any, I mean, I just, your website is so great. You have a list of every film and there's like a diary entry. And I was just scrubbing through, picking random films and reading. And I came across this story. Tell us about the last day of recording on Airheads.
Yeah, that was a good one. That's not the reason that I live on the East Coast, I'll hasten to point out. But yes, that we finished, you know, late. I don't know, like 2 or 3 a.m. And I went back to the hotel. I think I was staying at the Sunset Marquee in Hollywood. And really pretty soon after I went to bed, the Northridge earthquake hit. And now, because I'm an East Coaster, I had never actually felt an earthquake at all before. So I didn't know. Yeah, but I didn't know, is this a regular earthquake or is this a special earthquake? You know, I had no idea how to judge. But yeah. as it kept going on, I mean, to me, it seemed subjectively as though it went on and on and on and on. I thought, how long can buildings really stand up, you know, while this is going on? And the whole city blacked out the first, like, fraction of a second. But, yeah, I was in a hotel room. I didn't know where anything was. Like, I know they tell you you're supposed to get away from the window or the, you know, but it's all blacked out. And it's a hotel room, and I really couldn't even remember where the window or the mirrors or anything was. So I basically just decided, might as well stay in bed. Why, like, try to wander around when I don't know what I'm doing? Anyway, and yeah, so that was interesting.
This is crazy because there's no social media. You can't jump on and see, like, what are people saying, or, like, pull out your phone in bed and look it up or whatever. Like, what do you?
That's what's really
going
true.
Through your mind, or
I mean, I'm not so sure. I'm not sure the cell system would have worked if there was one. But you're right. It was. Being in a disaster zone, I was also like in downtown New York on 9/11. Like, I've learned now that when you're in a disaster zone, you know the least about what's going on. I went out, you know, in my bathrobe, and I could see that all the water had been thrown out of the pool, and everybody else is wandering around in bathrobes. We all go out onto the street, and someone had a car door open with the radio going, and that's how we found out what had happened and what the extent was. Wow. And it was the same thing on 9/11. No one had any idea what was going on. It was only a few people maybe had radios in their cars, knew. And anyway, so that was something. Of course, I lived
and
through
it. And you had mentioned, too, that, like, even in the days and weeks after, that the aftershocks were happening and you're working, trying to get this film done. People are running out of the building. I'm just picturing just chaos. Like,
yeah, we were doing the film mix and I forget where it was, but anyway, yeah, we're mixing on a stage where, you know, there is a tall, big stage like you have in LA. We don't have these in New York, but, you know, big stage with all these lighting fixtures up above, and the aftershocks would come and people would look up at the lighting fixtures and, like, and they're shaking and people would just run out. And then come back in. So it was just this constant, stress. At a certain point,
like,
I thought,
you need more of that on a film.
At a certain point, I thought, I don't need to really be here for this. And I went home. But that's not the reason that I don't live on the West Coast. I'm just, I like, how should I put it? You know, I'm more in my cultural leanings, more Eurocentric, and I like the old world and in the way that New York is. You know, it is that way, and the West Coast is points more to the West and is more of a frontier attitude. I don't know. I mean, I also like, you know, there's so many, I could just go on and on about the things I like about New York. I love that you'd ride in the subway and you're rubbing shoulders with people from all over the world. you know, you're all like there together, whereas in New York people are in LA people are in cars, you know. And I just love the way it's all just mixed up, and the cultures are like blocked from block to block. You go through these little cultures.
Yeah, it's
for a while now. I've run the New York Marathon a few times, and you just run through, like you go through every borough, run through these bits of Brooklyn and Queens I would never see otherwise. And each one, like on one block, there's like a Korean church choir standing on the street singing, and the next block is a Polish punk band out there playing, and the next block is a Hasidic, and you know,
like a Coen Brothers movie score.
I know.
Do you listen to music when you're running in the marathon? And if so,
oh my God, I certainly do. No, I'd be bored to tears. I could never do it without music. Well, I think it's interesting. Everybody, I think, has their own approach to that. For me, kind of trance type music works for me. So I listen to Underworld is basically my perfect band for running for me. Like, it's just interesting enough, but not too interesting. And it allows me to settle into a sort of a trance state.
I'm so impressed that you do a marathon. 26.2, is that correct?
I don't get down to that decimal level in my.
But you pull into Central Park and they throw a silver blanket over you.
Yeah, it's that's right. Yeah, and you see all these other people on stretchers, but no, it's great. I have to say, it sounds like a weird thing to say, but I really do think it's really enjoyable. I do like it.
I totally understand the New York attraction. I mean, I'm a New Yorker at heart, and even looking at our pictures right now on Zoom, this is what you see in LA. You see people in cars from the shoulders up, and that's all you see. You just see them through their car windows. And in New York, you really do exactly what you say. And I find, as a musician, truly inspiring to have that kind of interaction and have the experience of being with people and being in neighborhoods and hearing a Korean choir or a Polish punk band. In LA, I found when I moved here, that separation also kind of defeated a certain organic spontaneity of inspiration. So I like that you're still part of that. Will you come back in after your experience in Amagansett? Are you coming back to the city?
Well, yes. I mean, I still have a place in the city, and during the pandemic, I didn't really go in. But I have school age kids. I have teenagers, but I also have a 10-year-old daughter. So with kids, you basically have to settle into a place where they're going to go to school. So this is where they go to school. Yeah. But during the summer, I go in, and I think as she gets older, we can go back and forth more fluidly. Maybe we'll see. I miss the city, I'll be frank. But at a certain point, once I had kids and I had to settle somewhere, settling in Manhattan after having lived there for 30 years, it was starting to feel claustrophobic to me. Mm. And I had lived more, a musician life before that. I rented a house at a second house in Big Sur, and I'd go back and forth between Manhattan and Big Sur. And that was like a weirdo balanced life to me. But once I couldn't do that anymore, I felt I had to choose a place with a little more nature than Manhattan. And that's why I came out here.
I just got back from there, and it's so different. Carmel feels like Europe. It's completely different vibe, and it's not very far from L.A. We were talking about the Coen brothers, and your relationship with them is unique in that so many composers would love to find the director that they can pair with for this many films. And I'm wondering, at what point in your relationship with them, do you remember feeling like, wow, we have a total second hand, we don't even need to speak anymore? Or are you at that level? Like, what is your guys' conversation like as you team up for a film? And then how do you begin your process with a film for them, say, versus somebody else? Because you've bonded long enough, it seems like you might have some glue there.
Yeah, well, of course, that's true. Although, in truth, I think you could also say that it's not like these guys like to sit around and talk and analyze their films. So the honest answer is, it wasn't that different when we did Blood Simple or Raising Arizona than it is now, in the sense that they don't really... you know, we go through the film, but they don't sit there and say, oh, I think, you know, this character is this and this is this situation is that. And they just really hate to do that. It's like pulling teeth. And we only do that if we've got a problem. If we've got, if I've tried like five things and none of them are working for them, then we sit back and say, okay, well, let's talk about what's this really about? You know, what's really going on here, and try to analyze it. And even then, I don't even know how helpful it's ever been. They just, if you ever see them being interviewed, you will see this, and they just don't like to approach it in that way. Not for me, not for anybody else. So I think it's more that we just so happen, and this is just chance, or maybe it's Skip, thanks to Skip, but we just have very similar sensibilities. You know, I studied film in school. So we've seen, you know, we come from the same background of film, the films that we love, and they're well read, and they, you know, one thing you can see in their movies is that they have respect for the meaninglessness of life, and I do too, you know. And I think, so in many ways, we just happen to see things and see film in similar ways. So indeed, we don't actually talk that much about why we're doing stuff. You know, I love to talk about it. I'm happy to, but they really don't.
I like a quote
Robert
of
mentioned
yours.
You go ahead, Robert.
I like a quote of yours that you said you both have the same sensibility, that I thought perfectly sums up the really great composers who know this, and maybe it's the great filmmakers. You said comedy is best played with a straight face. And I think the Coen brothers do that as filmmakers. They don't come in, and you, of course, as a composer, underline scenes that are sort of, is this comedic? It's so fucking out there. And yet the music says this is serious. But what's happening on screen is so kind of wacky that I'm not sure. And then you realize comedy's best played with a straight face. The composer's saying, I'm going to treat this utterly seriously. And you're going to identify the comedy in it as the audience. And it works perfectly. Fargo, for example. When I listen to that music away from the film, and it's hard not to attach it to the film, there's a certain melancholy in there. There's a certain kind of, I hate to say it, but it's kind of iciness. You feel the chill. Mm-hmm. And yet what's going on stage or on film is insanely funny. But you're not saying, wah, 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 wah. You're saying, yeah, that guy's in the wood chipper. So,
well, you know, part of that, I mean, I agree with everything you've said. Part of it is that for that film, the music is kind of seeing things from the point of view, a lot of the time seeing things from the point of view of Fran's character. And to her, it is sad. Why do people act this way? Why is this going on? It's so, you know, oh, gee, why does this, you know, person get shot in the back for no reason? So that's partly why the melancholy works. But you're right. I mean, I'll say Joel and Ethan have a very strong silliness tendency in their work, but by playing serious music against some of the silliness, it just becomes discomfort. It's a different kind of humor. That's the humor of discomfort, and I think that's a lot of what the music is giving you. Yeah. But far be it for me to analyze it too much.
I mean, I just love to know what you do when you have other directors. And I look at a variety of directors, and they don't get that. And they want you to be on the nose. I mean,
well, it's different. I'd say that, for instance, with Martin McDonagh, who I've worked with several times now, his is more a sensibility that's not dissimilar to Joel and Ethan's. And it's different, but not completely different. But then when I do things with Todd Haynes, Todd, he'll do films. We've done things that are outright melodrama, like Mildred Pierce. And Carol touches on melodrama. It's not exactly that, but for me, that's very hard. I have to say, I'm fine playing, you know, a love theme if someone is about to be killed, and I'm fine playing, you know, darkness if people are falling in love. But playing what you're actually seeing on screen and playing it sincerely is difficult for me. I'll just be honest. I don't see life that way, and Todd drags me into these productions, which I'm glad he does. It's great. He's stretched me as a composer, but I find that very difficult. Playing, you know, dark humor, playing irony is very much my natural propensity, and playing sincerity and melodrama, oh, so hard for me. But then for so many other composers, I think it's a natural thing for me. It's very hard.
Though you and I both know so many composers. I think composers are, behind closed doors, some of the wackiest and most cynical. And, you know, they have to play that sincerity to keep the gig. But you and I both know that when it's off campus, in fact, I'm always impressed when it's off campus and they don't say, "This is crazy, you know, what the guy wants me to do." And it might be that, you know, they have to tell themselves, "I understand what he wants. I'm going to try and score that scene with the puppy and the toaster with a lot more emotion, because that's what they're looking for." But I think that's the hardest thing of all, which is invest those scenes.
Oh my God. Yeah.
With something. Because to be a composer, if you don't have a good sense of humor and you don't have a good sense of cynicism, you'll never survive.
I know. I think that's true.
We talked about a lot of films. You've done 90 films. But up until recently, you hadn't done a television series. Obviously TV's changed a lot since when you started composing to now. It's very cinematic and it's much like a film at times. But what was there a reason you didn't pivot into TV until The Morning Show, I think, was your first series? Did it just not come up? Were you just busy? Like, what was the reason you made the decision to dive into TV?
Well, so the simplest answer as to why I didn't do it before is that I don't really watch TV. So I don't really understand it as a medium. When I see a film, I usually know right away what I think should be done with the music. I just really do know. And I don't have that feeling about television. I don't, especially the open-ended series concept like The Morning Show, where there's no real end. I mean, there's an end to the season, but then it will, you know, the story will continue and it will continue. It's hard for me to get it. And I have to say, I think only by the end of the first season of The Morning Show did I even begin to really conceive of how maybe to look at it. But, that's hard for me. It's just funny. I was talking to Joel about it. Joel has a funny thing to say about television, which is, you know, a movie has a beginning and a middle and an end. And I have to say, when I'm writing, I'm thinking about the end. When I start that movie, I'm thinking about the end. And I've got a plan for how all the thematic material is going to come together at the end. But Joel, so the television show has a beginning and a middle and a middle and a middle and a middle, and then it just peters out. and that's sort of true. And that's a different way of looking at things. I find it... I'm working on the second season of The Morning Show right now, and I think it's going absolutely fine, but that's because I've just stopped thinking about the end. I just realized it's not a thing. There is no end, and I'm just like, you know, kind of
it's a different
viewing
kind
it.
Of vessel.
Yeah, it is.
I think before we let you go, aren't you about to start a picture with just one Coen brother?
I actually just finished it, yes.
Oh, you just finished it?
Yeah, we recorded Macbeth actually in the spring, when it was still very much COVID time. Recorded it in New York in the spring, and I'm not sure. I mean, I think we're assuming it will come out before the end of the year, but I don't know an exact distribution schedule.
And did you have COVID style recording sessions where it was one at a time kind of thing?
No, we did. You know, I tried my best to write it for strings because I knew what the recording situation was going to be like. So if string players can wear masks, I did everything I could to write just for strings, but it is Macbeth, and there are the, you know, there are battle scenes and things. And in the end, I actually needed brass. So that presented a challenge.
Yeah.
But we did the brass in their own session, six players, like 12 feet apart with gobos in between them. And then after they played, no one was allowed in the room for 4 hours while they, you know, circulated the air and disinfected the place. It was like a hazmat site.
Jeez.
But I was so happy we got it done. And you can believe me, those brass players were happy. They probably had a call, you know, in a year.
So we
just finished it. And actually, it touches on something we were talking about before the first break, which is we're talking about synth and orchestra and stuff. And one of the things I did in this was to, record celli, basses acoustically, but then put them through distortion devices to distance them a little from the acoustic sound. And I think that's something people are doing a lot these days, where it's a direction, definitely a direction that sound is headed these days, is a manipulation.
Also makes it clear, as I even imagine it, that it's a Macbeth that has a particular emotional point of view that might not just be acoustic and old-fashioned, that it's going to say things that distorting the strings may help an audience understand we're not in Kansas anymore.
That's right. Yeah, it's a distorted world. That's right.
Is this the first time it's a solo Cohen?
That is correct. I think it really is. Ethan has written and produced on his own, I know, but this is the first time Joel's directing on his own. Ethan just didn't want to make movies anymore.
Are we going to look forward to a headline that says Coen Brothers at war over who gets Carter next?
No, I don't think you are. Ethan seems very happy doing what he's doing, and I'm not sure what Joel will do after this. But you know, they also have a ton of scripts that they've written over the years that are just sitting, you know, on various shelves. So I hope maybe they get back to some of those, because I've read some of them and they're great. But I don't know. It's, you know, we're all at an age where you just don't know what's, you know, we could all retire, but I don't think that's exactly going to happen. But, I mean, for instance, Fran, in many ways, her career is taking off as a producer and actor. I think it's a wonderfully unpredictable business, right? I just don't know.
It really is. I mean, you look at her last picture, and suddenly she's, you know, the most celebrated leading lady in the business. What a moment to have that happen.
I know.
And what a great, it is completely unpredictable. It's funny you say we're at an age where, I think one of the great revelations of this age is we've always been at that age where you don't know what's going to happen next. You just have this fantasy at some point that you have some measure of control, but it becomes clearer and clearer.
And I've talked, going back like probably 20 years, I used to talk to Tom Newman about it. And say, so do you think do people ever really retire from what we do exactly? And it seems more likely that your unwillingness to put up with, you know, bad behavior goes up, and your people's willingness to put up with your own, like, you know, requirements goes down. And, you know, at some point those curves intersect and you're just not getting calls anymore. I'm kind of assuming
your tolerance
like
retires you. Yeah. Yeah,
listen, exactly. I had the great good fortune of doing a picture with Ennio Morricone, and he made it clear right from the outset that if we were going to give notes, he wasn't interested. And it was sort of said, and we went ahead and kind of snuck in a couple, what do you think about? But, and it was a great director and huge movie stars and all that. And so he was a slightly flexible, but it was an interesting way in, which was sort of, I do what I do. Just, if there's any lack of clarity on that, I'm good. Let's part friends. And I thought, that's such a great way. It's like Jan Hammer putting the contract down. Here's the deal.
Right.
Take it or leave it. So,
Carter, do you think you would ever, like, do you have any signs of thinking, like, man, I've done all these films and I just want to go sit on a beach somewhere? Or are you still getting that excitement, like, every time you sign up for a project?
Well, I do get excited about new projects. That's That's true. And but I will say last year I was unwillingly unemployed because of the pandemic. And yeah, so for like 9 months I didn't do anything. And I have to say I kind of enjoyed sitting on the beach and, you know, just spending the days with my kids. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, every composer you talk to will tell you that the schedules are the hardest thing about the job. And it takes you away from your family. It takes you away from the rest of your life. So, yeah, I mean, part of me likes that. But I think maybe I'm just going to like do that petering out thing instead of actually
maybe not.
Retiring.
You might have.
Well, I mean, look at John Williams. He was done, and then Indiana Jones, and then now he's conducting at the Hollywood Bowl this summer, and it's right. Like, how in the world is John Williams not just like going off to his own island at some point? It's just incredible to me.
I don't know if any of us ever have to really. In these kind of careers, it's different if you are a roofer and you just can't get up there anymore or something. I think in these kind of careers,
you need to create. Yeah.
And you don't have to decide. You can say, I'm going to wind it down, but somebody calls up and says, here's an interesting project. You know, it's not like I've absolutely closed the door, never again. So,
no, Carter, that's right.
We will look forward to hearing many, many decades ahead.
Yes.
Of cool music.
And before we go, we always ask, do you have any plans to do any sort of concert? I mean, you have tons of great scores, and this is the new hot thing. You're right in New York City area there, plenty of venues.
You know, I have never really enjoyed taking the music out of the film and playing it. I have done it because people have asked. It's just not really interesting to me. I wrote the music for the film, for the situations of the film. And, I mean, maybe when I'm retired, it would be something I'll
then you'll get
doing.
To work on it. Yeah.
But, I like writing music, and I'd much rather just write some new thing for a concert, setting than to just just take the film scores and do them. It's just honestly not that interesting to me.
So, Score fans, hold your cards and letters asking for a night of Carter Burwell music. Though it could happen, and I think it'd be I hadn't thought of it, but what a great show. I'll tell you why I know it's a great show, because I listened to the films of Carter Burwell, which goes up to 2017. There's that great compilation online, and I thought, oh man, this would be an incredible concert. So, Someday we'll get there. But Carter, it's been amazing talking to you and reconnecting. I finally found out what class you were in at Harvard, which is something I should have known and didn't. But why not ask it on a podcast? And
yeah,
enjoy Amagansett.
Oh, I will. Thanks. It was really great talking.
We appreciate it greatly. And a reminder to our listeners, you can follow us. There are a number of ways. Twitter at Score the Podcast, Instagram at Score Movie, Facebook Score a Film Music Documentary. And don't forget to subscribe on Patreon at More Score. Plenty of extra content you can't get here on the show, exclusive interviews and exclusive merch. And stick around after the show today. We're going to play you a clip from Spitfire Audio so you can hear some of the different sample sounds to help elevate your music. Robert, take it away, man.
What a treat. Once again, a genuine maestro joined us this week, and we look forward to hearing, is it called The Tragedy of Macbeth?
That is what it is called.
We're going to look forward to that. Carter, what a great opportunity to catch up for both of us and
thank
for
you
all
so
our
much.
Listeners. I appreciate it.
Thanks, you guys.
Hey, Score listeners, we are so grateful for the support of all our friends at Spitfire Audio. They collaborate with people like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music. You're about to hear a musical demo of what that sounds like.
And, Robert, as an exclusive to Score the Podcast listeners, you can save 25% off your first purchase of Spitfire products with the promo code SCORE2021, and you can even use it on this package that we're about to play you a clip from. It's the Hammers package. Check this demo out.
Hammer time.
Again, just go to Spitfire Audio. Robert said Hammer Time, and we all started laughing. Go to SpitfireAudio.com. Use the promo code SCORE2021. You can save 25% off that Hammers package. Their new package, Solstice, Albion Solstice, which is that came out last month. Tons of new stuff. And go get their free stuff, too. It's awesome, and it's free. We'll be back in a couple weeks here on Score the Podcast. You guys have a good one.